Welcome to Econ Talk, part of the Library of Economics and Liberty. I'm your host, Russ Roberts of Stanford University's Hoover Institution. Our website is econtalk.org, where you can subscribe, comment on this podcast, and find links and other information related to today's conversation. You'll also find our archives, where you can listen to every episode we've ever done going back to 2006. Our email address is mail@econtalk.org. We'd love to hear from you. Today is July 6, 2016, and my guest is Matthew Futterman, Wall Street Journal reporter and author of Players, The Story of Sports and Money and the Visionaries Who Fought to Create a Revolution, which is our topic for today. Matt, welcome to Econ Talk.
Thanks so much for having me.
So your book is a fascinating and incredibly entertaining look at a real revolution, how a sleepy part of our lives called sports became a multi-billion dollar behemoth, sometimes a monster, sometimes something very glorious. What changed? Obviously, a lot of things changed, but sometime between the 1950s and today, and it came at different times for different sports, but something changed, and it runs through your book. What is that?
Well, I think what really changed was the athletes, the people who are the real subjects of the book, that's why I called it Players, they really started agitating and they started pushing to be paid as professionals and to be paid what they were worth and what you would pay the so-called sort of star of the show. And once they started being paid as professionals, they got enough money to be able to work harder and train harder and get better at what they did. And once they did that, the products got a lot better, meaning that, you know, the shows they were putting on, the performances, and more people wanted to come see them and more people wanted to pay money to put them on TV. And the whole system sort of snowballed from there. But what it really starts with was, you know, paying the labor force what it deserved to be paid and valuing it in the way it deserved to be valued. And that sort of seems to have been the thing that really unlocked the box of sports. I think what's been said for a long time, what was always said for a long time, was that TV made sports. And you know, that is true to some extent. TV, you know, supplies the lifeblood, is really the lifeblood of sports. But sports had to become good TV before TV could make sports.
Yeah, and that's a fantastic insight. You know, if you had asked me before I read your book, why do athletes make so much money today compared to, say, 1950, I would have said something like, well, TV came along. It gave them exposure, allowed them to entertain a lot more people than they could have before. And eventually, of course, it went global through the internet. And so that opportunity to be a part of that much larger market is why sports got bigger. And a bunch of labor relations, decisions, strikes, et cetera, gave athletes a bigger share of that pie over time. And that's really the story. And what I learned from your book that I found so interesting was to appreciate that synergy you just talked about. It's obvious, we all know that is when you can make $10 million playing something rather than $25,000, more people are going to try to do it and to do it well. But I didn't think enough about how the product itself changed. You know, you go back and look at basketball players in the 60s and they look funny.
Yeah, I mean, go try and I always tell people, you know, when we start having these kinds of conversations, and because it's sports, it inevitably gets into a sort of debate and argument.
Everybody's an expert,
you're right? And I always tell people, and everybody should be an expert. That's the thing that's great about sports is, you know, I don't necessarily know anything more about it than anybody else does. I write about it a little more than other people do, and probably think about it too much for my own good. But you know, what I tell them is, you know, go back and watch a Super Bowl from the 1980s. A game that you thought was great, from a generation or two ago, and tell me if you can sit through it. because it's slow. The equipment is strange. The players aren't moving very quickly. And you say they look funny. They are completely different bodies at work there. The species hasn't changed. Evolution didn't suddenly change over the last 30 years. We know that didn't happen. What happened was training and practice and all these things that people didn't have time for because in the 50s, Arnold Palmer was a paint salesman in addition to trying to become a professional golfer. And Roger Staubach was selling real estate in the offseason when he was the starting quarterback of the Dallas Cowboys. All these things that took up people's time rather than things like, watching what you eat and going for a run and going to the weight room and doing all kinds of other exercises and sleeping, for instance. Things that are all incredibly important to what we know as sort of modern athletes. And that's where you get Steph Curry, and that's where you get LeBron James and any number of other athletes. It doesn't just happen.
But to take your point further, I think that's only part of the story. And that's the part that I understood. That's the part I knew. And certainly as an economist looking at the incentives, players want to play longer. When you can get a decent multi-million dollar contract in your late 30s, obviously you have an incentive to stay in shape and not get overweight and to keep your body healthy. And we all understand that part's pretty straightforward. The part that I didn't appreciate is the part that it's not just that the bodies are different, which, it's the difference really. LeBron James is almost a comic book character in his physique compared to a 1950s basketball player who looks something close to me, and I don't look so good. So, that's part of it. But the other part is when you watch that Super Bowl game from 1980 or better, 1970, the camera angles aren't so interesting. Replay isn't as interesting. And most importantly, and this is what your book really, I think, brings out, we did not have the emotional connection that we have today. Now, to some extent, that's an old story, right? Obviously, people loved, they loved Babe Ruth, they loved Ted Williams, they loved Will Chamberlain and Bill Russell. They loved these older figures. They were stars. They were celebrities of enormous proportion. But the marketing of both the player and the product, the game itself, radically changed in the last 20-something years, correct?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. It might stretch it out to 30 years, and in the 80s, and then mid 80s with the onset of Michael Jordan and the burst, the boom of Nike, because then Nike really sort of set the tone for marketing in the modern sports world. I think that's fair to say.
Yeah, and that's a mystery to me. And we're going to come back to that, but just the idea that you wanted to package players. A lot of people you talk about different myths about sports popularity. The standard myth about the NBA is that Magic Johnson, Larry Bird came along, their rivalry was exciting, they got to face off against each other multiple times, and then Michael Jordan took it to another level, and other sports have struggled to imitate that success, but that's the secret. And that is part of it, obviously. But as you point out, in other sports, other things happened. Football being the most interesting example for me, I would have given a similar story. But in that case, rule change played a huge part. So talk about that.
Yeah, well, the NFL in the 1970s, we talked about it being hard to watch. It was really hard to score in the late 70s. You had years where point totals where teams were scoring combined, 20 points a game, and shutouts were becoming common. And the rules committee, the people that were running the NFL, just realized that this just wasn't going to work. That people were people wanted to come to games and they wanted to see scoring. And so what they did was they changed the rules to open up the field, to make it easier, essentially, to move the ball down the field. And what's the easiest way to move the ball down the field? It's through a forward pass. But you couldn't do that under the old rules. The offensive linemen couldn't extend their arms when they were supposed to be blocking. If you could sort of imagine that, imagine trying to block J.J. Watt today without extending your arms. It was one real problem. The other problem was the wide receivers could essentially be assaulted on the line of scrimmage and as they moved downfield. And that rule changed where you couldn't have contact beyond 5 yards. And that really opened things up. But what the NFL realized also was the attention was going to have to shift from the sidelines to the field. And this has always been the league of Lombardi. And then it became the league of Montana. And so it went from being a coach's league to a quarterback's league. And that's what we see today. When you think of the NFL today, you think of Andrew Luck, and you think of Peyton Manning. Although you don't think, you're not going to think of Peyton Manning anymore.
I think about Tom Brady, Matt. So just right, FYI.
Yeah. Okay.
Just letting you know, Stan. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. the quarterbacks run. This is a quarterbacks league. The quarterbacks run the league. Quarterbacks are the stars of the show, and that is not in any way an accident. It's because that's the game they made. That's the game they created. And if you believe in markets, and I mostly do. Certainly, that's the game that people like, and that's the game that people have wanted to see.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's one thing to say that the rule change did this, or that the league has promoted quarterbacks in various ways, which they have. But the obvious way to see it is that very rarely does a team with a mediocre quarterback go very far in football these days. Everyone understands that a quarterback's a really important position. It's not really up for debate. And of course, the blind side, Michael Lewis's book is about the fact that protecting the quarterback is really important, and among other things.
What I think is really important is that, the NFL sort of, they sort of happened, the rule changes were very deliberate. But then you had these sort of, you had a coach like Bill Walsh out in San Francisco that could really sort of see where this was going. And he was the first one to really take advantage of the rule changes very quickly and understand how the game was going to change. And he not only adapted how the team was going to play on Sundays, but he adapted how the team practiced. You know, he stopped having contact. He stopped wearing down his players. He wanted them fresh, and he wanted them fast, and he wanted them speedy, and he wanted them healthy. And so you can see how a few rule changes, and when you change the emphasis of the game, how the people who are really thinking about it quickly and thinking ahead and thinking about the impact of these things, how they can adapt. And, you know, what I really wanted to do with this book was I wanted to sort of show how the decisions and the money, the things that, you know, sort of that take place off the field, how it really affected what happened on the field and how that's what really made sports. You know, nothing really happens by accident anymore. And certainly that's true in sports.
Yeah, and this happens in every sport to some extent. If you look at baseball, 1968, I think Kari Stremski led the American League with a .300 batting average, but it was really .299 something, and they rounded it up. Bob Gibson's Gibson's ERA was 1.12. And so they realized, oh, this isn't good for the game. It's good for pitchers, not so good for batters, and really bad for the game because people like scoring. So what did they do? They lowered the pitcher's mound. And I think they also subtly, in various ways, over time, changed the strike zone. You know, it's nominally from the knees to the arm. It went from the knees to the shoulders, and they changed it knees to the armpits. It's really waist, right. Almost to the nipples.
Waist to the belly button.
It's really, yeah. It's a very narrow zone, which makes it much easier for batters. And so that's what baseball did. Basketball introduced the 3-point line, and those three sports, football, baseball, basketball, all became much more offensive and much less defensive. And other sports, though, didn't change. So, like, the most obvious one is soccer. So soccer, you know, a lot of games end 0-0. And Americans find that incredibly frustrating. I don't know if there's something wrong with us, right with us. But to me, part of the challenge of soccer becoming more popular in the United States is that fact that scoring is relatively rare.
Well, I do think that, I mean, I think there is, yeah, scoring is somewhat rare. And I will admit that as I get older, I find myself much more drawn to the sports where it's harder to score.
Yeah.
I do find myself, I mean, I watch a lot of NFL, like everybody does. And even though it is getting increasingly hard to score in baseball, I find myself watching less baseball just because the ball is in play so rarely these days, and I think it's become increasingly boring. But you know, to get away from that and to get back to your original question about soccer, you know, week in, week out, the soccer games that are played at the top professional leagues in Europe are also pretty much unrecognizable from where they were 25 and 30 years ago. And if you talk about them not changing, you know, maybe the size of the field is the same and the goals are the same size, but it's a completely different ball. The fields are much more manicured. You know, it used to be maybe a couple of teams would have beautiful fields and everyone else would be playing on sort of ruddy, muddy grass. Now everybody has a field that's sort of like a pool table. The fields are watered down before to make them even faster. They have made tremendous changes to speed up those games as well. And they score goals. I mean, there are the occasional 0-0 games, but, you know, you much more often, and you know, I would encourage anyone who has sort of a knee-jerk reaction against soccer at this point to watch this, you know, beginning in the fall, these English Premier League games on Saturdays and Sunday mornings that NBC does such a great job of showing. And it's the real challenge, actually, for the soccer league in the U.S. is not so much competing against the other U.S. sports. It's competing against the great soccer from Europe that's now, because of, you know, media, so available to all of us. But those games are like the NFL. They are, you know, they are fast. There is scoring, and also completely almost unrecognizable from where they were a generation ago.
And I think just a huge increase in casual interest in the United States, partly because of the availability, and of course, but that's a simultaneous phenomenon. It's available because people are interested. So I think it probably will continue to grow. I don't know if it'll ever get into the pantheon for Americans of major sports, but it's sure getting close, even if it's just following European teams. There's a lot more passion out there.
The smart people that I talk to, they sort of think that in 20 years, the big sports in the U.S. will be the NFL, the NBA, and international soccer, English Premier, whether it's English Premier League or Spanish, probably English Premier League, because they're the best position and the richest at this point, and will probably for the foreseeable future continue to have the best players. Although with this whole Brexit thing, that's sort of a bit thrown up in the air.
Yeah, it's up in the air
itself. But yeah, that's and to their credit, they've. That didn't happen by accident either. I mean, late 80s, early 90s, English soccer was a mess. The stadiums were terrible. They were dangerous. They were dangerous and dirty and unpleasant. And they were not it was not the haven for international soccer players to go get rich. The players went to Italy at that point, Italy or Germany. Those are really the top leagues. And then there was a lot of investment in England, investment in the stadiums, and some change and a reformation of the top league, and investment from media companies, Sky specifically. And once they had the money, they were able to make these, not that they weren't professional before, but the players were just able to get much better. The quality was there, and the quality was able to improve. And there were, like I said before, the subtle rule and equipment changes that has really made the product much more appealing.
What's different about the ball?
It's a much livelier ball. It's almost like a volleyball now. It's smoother. The old ball that Pele was playing with all the the black and white hexagonals on it. It was sewn together in all those different pieces, hand sewn together in all those different pieces. It absorbed water so that if it ever rained, all of a sudden that ball would sort of turn into a lead balloon. The ball now is much more synthetic when you get down to it, and the grooves are much more subtle, so it flies faster, and it flies much more unpredictably. So it can bend much more. Players can really bend it, and it moves in the air, and that's why you see those crazy shots that really sort of spin around a wall and up into the corner of the goal.
I just want to say, though, I do think that Pele would be a successful player today, even if he didn't train harder and didn't have more time. And similarly, there, a lot of the players we were talking about that from ages past could compete under today's rules with today's fitness. But I take the point, it's a good point. I want to come back to something you said about Bill Walsh, because I think it's an interesting example about how he changed training and he changed practice. One thing it seems to me that's the case is that in a lot of sports in the past, because it was so uncompetitive, because there was so little money at stake, innovation was kind of rare. People were content to go with certain cultural rules of thumb about how you prepared for a game or how you prepared your team. And there wasn't a lot of innovation. And one thing I've noticed since more money is in sports is that being stuck in your ways is a lot more costly. I like to think that racism is down in sports. And one of the reasons is because it's too expensive to be a racist. And as sports has gotten a lot more profitable, it has reduced things like racism, but also things like, that's the way it's always been done. So you see tremendous innovation in basketball. You see it in football, maybe a little bit in baseball. You see it in some ways in the range of pitches that a pitcher will now have that's required to be successful has gotten larger. And certainly training has changed across all sports. And it's not enough to say, yeah, well, that's the way. I don't lift weights because that's bad for baseball. Nobody thinks that anymore. And a lot of those cultural norms changed as the game got more profitable.
Yeah, it's not just it's training, and it's also sort of player evaluation too. That is the real. I mean, that's probably the real innovation that's happened is the hunt for the secret data.
Yeah.
The hunt for those important numbers that will tell you who is better than whom.
The availability of data has made being a fan so much more entertaining for those of us who are statistically oriented. And I think, again, for some sports, soccer being an obvious example, you don't get that profusion of statistics that you get with baseball. And I think baseball, for all its flaws, has that appeal that I think will keep it going, although I agree with you, it's too slow. And I think these attempts to, quote, speed up the game, which have not been very successful, I think they need to do something a lot more radical, and I think they eventually will. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I think they're going to be forced to. I just think that very few sports have the luxury of asking fans to spend 3 hours with them these days. Football you do, but there's only 16 games in a season. And there's a lot of games going on at one time, and people are playing fantasy, so there's a lot of distraction going on these days. So it's been able to work for them. But baseball is asking fans to pay attention for at least 3 hours, for give or take a couple of minutes, 3 hours, at least 3 hours, 162 times a year. In today's world, that's a big ask.
But it's working. And it's more than that. It's just what happens on the field needs to be sped up too.
What's unfortunate. There's so many simple things that can be done that they seem averse to doing. The first thing you just gotta get rid of those noun conversations. You get rid of those.
Yep.
if you want to change pitchers, signal manager stays in the dugout, stands up on the top step, says, "You come out, you come in," and then the pitching and the change happens. Just like that, you can shave several minutes off the game. They've gotten better about not letting people step outside of the batter's box. They've gotten better, a little better, about forcing pitchers to pitch. They could do much, but they could do much more. That is the one thing. If you watch a game from 50 years ago, it's striking how quickly the pitchers pitch, and how quick, it's ball goes back to the pitcher, ball is thrown. Ball goes back to the pitcher, ball is thrown. It's really striking, and that's something that I'm not sure when exactly they got away from it. Maybe with Ricky Henderson adjusting his batting glove after every pitch, but it was something disastrous happened over the last 20 or 30 years lost control of it.
Yeah, but I think that slowdown is partly a result of the money, because anyone at bat's a lot more important now. Anyone pitch is a lot more important. So people know that their statistics matter. So there's just a lot more care into each at bat and each pitch. And so they go through a bunch of rituals to get themselves in the right frame of mind, either as a pitcher or batter. And I think baseball's just going to have to change that from the top down. An amazing example this year was the discussion of whether an intentional walk should be, you shouldn't have to throw four pitches. You should just say signal the person going to first. And it really illustrates the point I'm trying to make about tradition. A lot of people are offended by that. They're not just like, I don't know if that's a good idea. It's like, how dare they do that? How dare? Sometimes that walk, that pitch goes wide. And sometimes
I think I've seen that once in my life. I know I have seen it once. I don't think I have seen it twice.
I've seen somebody swing at a pitch and put a ball in play unexpectedly. It's exciting once out of thousands of times.
Thousands of times in thousands of minutes.
But
we're asked to pay attention to the most predictable thing that could possibly happen.
And what's more untraditional than changing the height of the mound? So, or a designated hitter? These were all things done to bring more offense into baseball. And I think if baseball continues to decline as a attraction, they'll change. These norms and these traditions will change. Let's talk about young people, children, and how the amount of money in sports has changed the way that parents and their kids approach sports. And you use the example of Nick Bollettieri's academy in tennis. What was his insight, and how has it affected tennis and other sports?
Well, I think his insight was similar to the insight. I guess I'll step back from him for one second just to sort of lead up to him. And the original insight was by the guy who's sort of credited with being the father of the modern sports industry, Mark McCormick, who I spent the first couple of chapters writing about. And, he was sort of the first person to see this whole cycle working together of, more money to the players, more time to practice, product gets better, more money into the system, and the jobs become more desirable, more competition for the jobs, which makes the product even better. So what Bollettieri saw was more money. Well, the part where he saw was more money going into the system, tennis becoming professionalized, which it really wasn't before 1968. There was just a few tennis players because the tennis tour was awful to the extent that a professional tennis tour even existed. It was just a bunch of guys sort of barnstorming around the world. And his insight, once it got professionalized and more money was going into it, that more kids were going to want these jobs. And more parents were going to want these kids to have these jobs. Everybody was sort of up in arms the other day when Maya Dorado, the very talented young swimmer for the U.S., she's 23, 24 years old, went to Stanford, and after these Olympics isn't going to swim anymore because she has a job at McKinsey. And people can't imagine the idea that she's going to give up of job or life as a professional swimmer to
those
go
are
work
people.
At McKinsey.
Those
to
are
go
people
work
who've never
McKinsey.
Thought much about what it's like to be a professional swimmer, I don't think.
Right, exactly. They haven't thought too much, and I can tell you,
getting
I can tell
up
you
at
that
five
if
in the morning.
One, oh, if there's one sport where the training and the practice is just absolute drudgery and just staring at that black line for hours and hours a day, it's swimming. So I can understand it. But it struck me as funny because, 30, 40 years ago, of course you wouldn't be a professional anything. Of course you'd take the job at McKinsey. But Bolitari saw that was going to change. And that was changing. And so what he wanted to do was flip this American idea of being a well-balanced child and a well-balanced teenager and a well-balanced adult on its head. And, you know, if you're a teenager and your future was tennis, then you should practice tennis 8 or 10 hours a day and maybe go to school for 3 hours a day instead of the opposite ratio. And it was sort of blasphemy at the time. And now it's one of those things that is sort of like, well, yeah, of course. And what's interesting about it is that what's always been interesting about it to me is that we have this, you know, we have this sort of prejudice still against athletic prodigies doing that. It still exists. I can tell you it does because, you know, if in your neighborhood or on your street there's some kid who's really good at something and he's spending all, is really good at, hockey or soccer or tennis or golf, and he enrolls in one of these programs and dedicates his life this way, you know, there is a certain amount of sort of parental judginess that will go on. But if that kid is a great ballet dancer or a great pianist, we never say that kid shouldn't go to a conservatory. No one ever judges the prodigies in the arts or in other pursuits, but there is something that I think people sort of still see as kind of crass about doing that.
Well, I think the issue there, it's fascinating that it happened and that it's the intensity of it, and I assume it's, you know, it's spread way beyond this phenomenon of just an academy. Of course, it's the travel team phenomenon that you write about. It's just happening all through every level of sports.
Yeah, it fed down. It started with the academy, but it sort of fed down to, okay, well, now we'll get academies in every town, and it created something of a lunatic system in some ways, so that even if your child isn't a prodigy, and like most of them probably will never even play for a Division I college soccer team, chances are her travel team that she's playing for has a coach who's ultra competitive and wants her to only play that game by the time she's 11 years old. Yeah. So yeah, it does have its downsides. But
and I think the other part is, well, first there's the uncertainty, as you point out. I think an extraordinarily gifted musician, an extraordinarily gifted athlete, we're a little more understanding of this. The problem is the people who think, well, there's a chance, so let's devote our lives to it. And a lot of people, of course, can't make it literally. It's just not going to happen. It can't be the case that there's only be top 10 tennis players in the world at any one time. There's 100,000 who think they have a shot at it, and maybe a couple of them do.
And only about 80 of them make money these days.
But I, you know, when you read a book like Open by Agassi, which is, I thought, really an amazing autobiography, a kind of book I normally wouldn't pick up, but it was, I think I've mentioned it before on the air, just a really gripping, fascinating read about all the different aspects of being a professional athlete. Didn't seem so healthy for him, at least, to go through that experience.
Right. No, I think he's, and Andre is, you know, an incredibly self-conscious person and one of the smartest, least educated people, and really sort of self-educated at this point because he's so incredibly well-read now. He sort of became in his 30s this, like, just completely voracious reader and has read everything. But yeah, there's that heartbreaking moment when he's, I think he's 15 or 16, and he wins a tournament, and he had entered as an amateur, and I think there was like a $2,500 prize for it, and he called his dad, and he said, "What do I do?" And his dad said, "Andre, you're not qualified to do anything else with your life. Take the money and turn professional." And it was just sort of, it was completely heartbreaking. I mean, imagine being told when you're 16 that you can only do one thing, that you've, everything else is gone. You can only do one thing. So yeah, it didn't, I mean, I think he didn't get great messages from it. You know, it can work. Though I think Maria Sharapova, you know, granted she's got some problems these days with taking that medicine, but I think I don't know that she would trade the life she's had for anything. You know, it's the fact is that if you're going to be an elite athlete these days, you're probably going to have to focus pretty hard on it from a pretty young age.
Yeah, no, that part I think is true, and that's the way the world is right now, for better or for worse. That's just reality. Let's talk about the Olympics. They're coming up here in the United States and elsewhere. Where are they? They're in Brazil this year. I think in my mind, they're coming up here in the United States because that's where I'm going to watch it. I'm not going to Brazil.
Right.
But, you know, the interesting thing for me is Michael Phelps, if I'm correct, made the U.S. swim team. He's an old man by the historic standards of the sport, a really old man. So talk about how that changed and why it changed.
Well, you talk about the historic standards of the sport. I think for a very long time there was this idea that swimmers peaked in their early 20s, and women swimmers may even peak even younger than that, and it's completely wrong. Swimmers peak when every other athlete peaks, which is their mid to late 20s.
28.
And the,
28.
Right, and the reason we thought this was because no one dared swim after they were 21 or 22 years old because you couldn't make any money doing it. Because you would go to the Olympics, you had to be an amateur. It was the Mark Spitz story. And, you know, you won your medals and then you went to become like a D-list actor who was doing guest appearances on, you know, Emergency and The Love Boat. And that was sort of the opportunity that you had. But what changed was you had a group of athletes who got tired of taking $750 or $1,000 or $1,500, whatever it was, under the table from the organizers of events, who also happened to be the people who are making the rules saying that they couldn't take any money or be paid as professionals. And they said, "This system is ridiculous. We're working harder than anybody else. We want to be paid as professionals." I mean, the person I focus on this, because I think he's so interesting and because he's had such an interesting life, was Edwin Moses, the great hurdler from the 70s and 80s, who has this unbelievable thing that he did, which was that he didn't lose a race for about 10 years. The 122 races, his specialty was the 400-meter intermediate hurdles. And, I mean, it's astounding what he did, but the only reason he was able to do it was because he got them to change the rules. And he was able to pursue running professionally. Professionally. He was, at the time, he won his first gold medal in the Olympics in 1976. He was at Morehouse College on an academic scholarship because he was pretty slow in high school, but then he had this growth spurt and he did really well. And, you know, by this time he was junior in he was the best in the world by the time he was a junior in college. And then after that, he went to work for General Dynamics as an engineer, and it was the Cold War, and he could, and that was really advantageous for him because General Dynamics had was working 3 8-hour shifts designing, you know, weapons and missile systems because they had all these government contracts. And so he would work, he was an engineer on the 4 to 12 shift. So he would train in the morning and early afternoon and then show up at work at 4 and work till midnight and do it all over the next day. And that got, you know, wouldn't you know, that actually got a little tiring. And so he was agitating, and he was really smart, and he was, you know, a gold medal winner. So that always gives you a certain amount of authority. He had the good fortune of being an athlete at the time when Juan Antonio Samaranch took over the International Olympic Committee. And now Juan Antonio Samaranch has a lot of faults, and like to be referred to as, you know, Your Excellency, and was a buddy
Don't
of Franco.
Right, exactly.
Was a buddy
human
of Franco.
Fault.
Right, and
but
one thing he did get, he ended up on the right side of history with, was he realized that in order for the Olympics to survive, there were going to have to be a competition between the best of the best. It was no longer going to be able to survive as a sort of quirky amateur competition because people weren't going to be interested in that. And he set up the system and, well, you know, got the enough support. And in working with athletes like Moses, was able to change the rules so that professionals could, so that you could be a professional Olympian. And what do you know? When you can be a professional Olympian, you can race for 10 years. You keep training and training hard and making money and race for 10 years and not lose. Or you can be like Michael Phelps and, you know, you can break Mark Spitz's record in your third appearance at the Olympics and then come back a fourth time and, you know, become the most decorated Olympian ever, and then come back a fifth time to try, as he's doing now, and try and solidify your legacy, and he'll probably pick up another gold medal or two along the way at 31 years old.
But it really illustrates the point that which you know runs through your book, which is, again, and not so easy to see, which is this synergy between the attractiveness of the sport, the quality of the play, the amount of money that's in it, which feeds back into the incentive to get better and to be able to market a better product. Obviously, you know, ABC did an amazing job over the years humanizing the Olympics. You know, when I think of the Olympics, for better or for worse, I often think of Jim McKay telling some story about some tragedy.
Oh, definitely for better.
Right?
Jim McKay, definitely for better.
I think he's a giant.
And,
but what he did is...
If you haven't watched the Jim McKay documentary on HBO shows late at night sometimes, make sure to watch it, because there's this absolutely priceless moment from, I think, the 1960s where Jim McKay is announcing the ice barrel jumping competition from one of the resorts in the Catskill Mountains. And it is as riveting, and he is able to make it as riveting as, you know, the 100 meters, the men's 100 meters in any Olympics. So, yes, definitely for better with Jim McKay.
And it's all about storytelling, and it's all about the humanizing of the athlete and making you care way beyond the event, way beyond the competition, giving you this visceral emotional connection to somebody you've never heard of, that suddenly you're rooting for and caring about. And basically, it's a different product. I think that's the most important lesson here. It's that they took something that looks like a game and they made it into a drama in a way that people hadn't thought of before, and that allowed the money to flow in because people cared, and that in turn allowed the product to get better, and that created more eyeballs, which created more money. And it's to some extent a virtuous circle, although, as I think you and other sports fans occasionally lament, it changes things, and you don't always There's some downsides to it.
Right, and with the Olympics, the important thing also is that, you know, you create all these characters, and then you don't kill them, okay? You don't kill them after one season, because that's what they were doing.
Yeah,
you know,
it's not
that's
Romeo
what it
and
was.
Juliet.
You couldn't afford, I mean, imagine if every TV series could only have one season, and then you had to have all new characters. That's what they were trying to do with the Olympics. And the explosion in the value of the TV rights in the Olympics comes when the professionals can come back year after year after year, and it becomes a great TV show because we know these people. You know, we know, you know, whether it's Michael Phelps or, you're going to get to know there's this sprinter that's going to run for the U.S. Her name is English Gardner. And she's got a pretty good chance of winning a medal or maybe winning a gold medal. And she's 23 years old and her parents are ministers from New Jersey. She grew up, with two nickels to rub together. And, you know, she's 23 years old and she's an Olympic rookie, but she talks like she's, you know, a 35-year-old veteran. And, you know, you're going to start to, if she stays healthy, you're going to know her as well as you know your next door neighbor over the next 10 years. And so, yeah, that's where it's like you said, it's that synergy. And yes, look, I get it. There are, there is that downside. There was something unique about, the quasi, I hate the word purity, but, you know, for lack of a better term, the supposed purity. But it really wasn't pure. Is there purity in a system where the organizers of it are pushing a system that essentially artificially keeps down their labor costs and allows them to make money on their side businesses,
right? It's really an ugly system.
But
the irony of all this, which I think, you know, also comes out in your book, and I reminded me a little bit of this moment. I forget what book it was. It's Econ Talk guest of long, long ago, maybe back in 08 or 09, where the author was recounting the history of a videotape. And how horrified movie executives were that people might be able to watch a videotape with somebody else in the room who hadn't paid for it. And they would lose some money that way without realizing that they were standing on this enormous profit monster that they were holding down foolishly, short-sightedly. And so here are these owners who were keeping down the players, paying them a pittance, in baseball and in football, just horrible. They would give them a contract. They had no alternatives. There was no free agency. They'd have to threaten to do something instead of playing baseball. It wasn't a very viable threat. The players would. And when that changed, everybody got richer. It was just a terrible mistake on their part to think that somehow they were benefiting from exploiting the athletes. Everybody was losing. Everybody was missing a chance to, and especially the fans.
Especially the fans and especially the owners of the poorer teams. I mean, for years, you know, Kansas City was basically just a farm team of the New York Yankees. Now Kansas City is the world champions. Yep. And, you know, you could complain. There was all those years of complaining. Oh, well, free agency is going to kill the small market teams. It pushed so much more money into the system and forced these franchises to operate like real businesses because that was what they were going to have to do in order to compete. And yes, a lot of families that had owned these franchises couldn't afford to compete anymore, and they had to sell. But they did pretty well when they sold, and the new people who came in were able to, you know, like it's in some ways like any other business, in some ways completely different. But that's sort of this idea that if you suppress and pay your workers as little as possible and discourage competition, that's the road to success. I don't know where exactly that we got that idea, but you know, time and again, it shows in industry to industry, it seems not to be true.
So let's turn to Nike. I'm recording this in the summer. I come out to Stanford to the West Coast office of the Hoover Institution, and I'm about probably about 500, maybe 400 yards from the Knight Management Center, K-N-I-G-H-T, named after Phil Knight, who made a rather substantial gift to Stanford's Graduate School of Business. And, you know, we just sort of take this for granted that Nike is this incredibly wealthy company. But if you'd gone back to, say, 1970 or so, when he was first getting started, when Nike was first getting started in the late 70s, can you imagine saying that one of the most successful sports companies and businesses in the world is going to sell sneakers? I don't understand how they pulled it. I'm somewhat mystified by how they have identified success with shoes. You know, when you think of all the things that could have been different, or why it would work at all, it amazes me.
Well, what they, I mean, you said had built this massive success over selling shoes. What they realized, and, you know, Phil Knight has talked about this, is that their main product was selling stories. You know, shortly around the time of Michael Jordan, in the mid 80s, and, you know, the Michael Jordan boom into the late 80s, they realized that they were not so much an equipment company, but a marketing company. That's where their main strength was. And yes, they do put a tremendous amount of money into research and development. And yes, they do create good products. Some good products. But a lot of people make good shoes. Yeah. But what they understood before anyone else did, was that it wasn't so much about the shoe, that it was about what that swoosh represented and the people that they could get to wear that shoe and the story that they could tell and the sort of legend that they could spin about that person. And sometimes it works really well. It's worked more often than not. And sometimes it works famously horribly. And, you know, we know those stories too well, too. The most famous of them, I guess, you know, would be Lance Armstrong, where they create this whole campaign about an athlete that was basically a complete farce. But what you get back to ultimately is how they changed, and once again, we were talking about that, you know, that relationship between what happens off the field and what happens on the field, sort of how they changed the sort of emphasis that different athletes put on different aspects of their career. And what really became important to a lot of athletes is not so much, you know, how many championships I've won or exactly how many points I've scored or how I can help my team and all those things, but what's my story here? And you go back to Michael, and sometimes the story is true, sometimes the story is not so true. You go back to the famous story that everyone thinks they know about Michael Jordan, that he got cut from his high school basketball team. He didn't actually really get cut from his high school basketball team. He just didn't make varsity as a freshman, which is an entirely normal thing to happen, even to really good basketball players.
Who haven't hit their growth spurt yet.
Right, he just played JV as a freshman, and then grew, and then was a superstar by the time he was a sophomore. But it sounds much better if you say he got cut from his high school basketball team and, you know, struggled against the adversity and came back from defeat, and the legend begins to grow. You say, oh, well, what's the difference there? Well, the difference becomes when you become addicted to the legends, and you become, and so then there are certain legends that become irresistible, like Lance Armstrong beating cancer and coming back to win the Tour de France. And you know, so what do? You make a commercial that says, you know, what am I on? I'm on my bike 6 hours a day, when, you know, the truth is that he's on a lot of other things besides his bike 6 hours a day. And that's where the danger comes in. And I think that's the part where we get most irritated in sports, and like in every other aspect of life. You know what? People don't really like to be lied to, or they don't like to be sort of made fools of, or have things pulled over on them.
And I have to interrupt, because, you know, we're not going to name any names, but it is July, and November 2016 is coming soon, and somehow people managed to. They're going to vote for a bunch of people who are going to lie to them lot. So I think I would take a different tack. I would say that, you know, lying to us in sports is somewhat harmless, somewhat harmless. You know, the fact that Michael Jordan really didn't do X, Y, or Z is maybe not the worst thing in the world. Even Lance Armstrong, I mean, it's an incredible Shakespearean tragedy, the whole thing. And he humiliated his friends who lied, you know, to him. And he made a lot of money dishonestly. True. But if it hadn't come to light that he was a cheater, a lot of people would have been happy, would have used that as a motivation, would have inspired people. You know, it's a little bit like, you know, fairy tales, literally, right? These are fairy tales that they're morality tales that have sometimes an unhappy ending, and we learn a different lesson from it. I just find it fascinating that you can spin those stories to the extent that you can get people to pay that much money for a shoe, and why it's a shoe and not something else. You know, obviously athletes endorse lots of products, but somehow the fact that it's used in – if I had to think about why Nike is successful, there aren't many things as a non-athlete I can do and be like Mike as a basketball player. Yeah, I can drink his Gatorade or whatever it is, or I can drive the car he endorses. But if I wear his basketball shoes, it's kind of like I'm like him, really, as a basketball player. Or if I use, you know, the racket that Sampras uses or whatever.
Oh, God, you're going to break your arm if you use Sampras' racket. It's like so heavy. That's the crazy. That whole Wilson is the worst racket.
I don't know.
Like a meat cleaver.
I don't know why his name came to mind. But anyway, I just think it's the ability, you know, the consumer version of this is Coca-Cola. So Coca-Cola is a good tasting soft drink. There are a lot of decent tasting soft drinks that are water and sugar and a little bit more. But it created something else, a feeling, an aura, a brand that's different. And Apple has done that, right? It's hard to understand why some make it and some don't, and why some are successful and some aren't. I don't know.
Yeah, I think if you get back to Nike, I mean, they made it because they had really cool commercials.
Yeah.
You can name five of them. You mentioned it was a Gatorade commercial. You mentioned Michael Jordan, but you know, those great, they had Spike Lee directing their commercials in the 1980s. In this sort of edgy way, they were just telling these great stories of inspiration while everyone else was talking about the great technical, the great molded soul or something like that. Maybe it's the difference between prose and poetry, or it's a difference between there's that old when Democrats used to lose a lot of national elections, I used to read about how a progressive or a Democrat could logically explain to a voter why they should vote for them, whereas the people who are really good at running these campaigns would inspire them. Would talk about big ideas like freedom and things like that. You wouldn't get into the logic so much. And in terms of why someone like Nike was successful is because they were talking about big things. They were talking about dreams and just do it and getting off your couch and, you know, let everybody else, try and, you know, tell me about the technical aspects of why this shoe might make you go faster when it really doesn't.
It's just hard to understand why telling somebody to just do it. It makes me want to buy their shoe, but it's working.
It has worked for a long time.
We're almost out of time. I want you to reflect on something that's not in your book, which is, you know, you're a great writer.
I'd say I'm a great rewriter.
Yeah, you're a great writer.
You saw my raw copy.
No, but it's a phenomenal thing that in 2016, there are a lot of people who can make a living writing about sports. There are a lot of people who spend immense amounts of time thinking about sports as a leisure activity. So when I think about when the fall comes and fantasy football comes along, the fantasy football season, the amount of hours that Americans spend playing fantasy football and paying attention to their draft and watching their teams and looking for trades and all, just it's an incredible statement about our wealth as a country, the amount of time we spend watching a 24/7 sports channel, reading about on the web all the statistics of all these players across all sports. This is another aspect of sports that has so changed. You know, when I was a kid, I looked at the box scores. I learned what players hit in their careers. I loved baseball statistics. But today, kids know, and adults, such an immense range of stuff about so many sports. And I just find that a different aspect of this transformation that we haven't talked about. So close us out by reflecting on that.
Well, I mean, I do think sports still has, when sports work, they have a way of sort of inspiring us and may make us think about what's possible in a way that nothing else does. You know, you get back to the Olympics, which are coming up. The Olympics are a lot of different things. They're kind of over commercialized, and they're a spectacle, and they're a TV thing. But at their root is this really big idea, which is that the Olympics is essentially a peace movement, and that's sort of how it was founded originally, and the importance of that part of it, I think, is still there today and is part of the reason why we're kind of attracted to it. There's a big idea behind it. And the idea is that, you know, there's a lot of problems in the world and there's a lot of countries that fight with each other. But if for 70 days, every 2 years or 4 years, you know, if it depends on how you measure the summer or the winter, a few thousand athletes, or in the case of the Summer Olympics, 10,000 athletes, can live in the same village and eat in the same dining room and compete on the same field of competition, maybe the world can become a better place. And every basketball game and every baseball game doesn't have that overtly, but there's some sort of larger idea to it, whether it's beauty or whether it's something very elemental, or simply fairness, or like you said, there's much less racism in it now because of lots of other different aspects to it, to the sports. There's an ability for, as much as these things can irritate us, they can make us feel like, there's something larger going on there, and they can not just build character, but also reveal character in ways that other activities simply can't. And it's neat to watch the people who are. It's neat to have the ability to watch the people who are the best ever at these things apply their traits, and when they do it well, and when they do it with a sort of grace and humility, it's a special thing.
My guest today has been Matthew Futterman. His book is Players. Matt, thanks for being part of Econ Talk.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. It's been great.
This is Econ Talk, part of the Library of Economics and Liberty. For more Econ Talk, go to econtalk.org, where you can also comment on today's podcast and find links and readings related to today's conversation. The sound engineer for Econ Talk is Rich Goyette. I'm your host, Russ Roberts. Thanks for listening. Talk to you on Monday.